ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer and a whole new year. I'm David Marr, and we're coming to you from Sydney on Gadigal land. With the help of AI, we've consulted the astrologists of the world for their predictions for 2026. They turn out to be speaking almost as one. This year we'll see energy shift from earth to air, from water to fire, offering fresh beginnings, spiritual awakening, and the shedding of stale and useless habits. But as we've achieved all that and more in 2025, we're going to relax for a couple more weeks, revisiting the best of the year that's gone, starting with the story of shade. We can't survive without it, but shade is becoming a luxury in this warming world. Later in the show, the history, the philosophy, and the future of shade. But first, time and documents are indispensable to history, or so we've always thought. Without clocks and archives, how can history be written? How can we make sense of the past? For a while now, these assumptions have been in dispute as historians turn their attention to this country's past before white men came to make their own history here. Historians like Jackie Huggins and Anne McGrath talk of deep time and deep history. They've just edited a collection of essays by many historians that's called Deep History, Country and Sovereignty. And they join me now. Professor Jackie Huggins of the University of Queensland is an author, a Bidjara elder. The elder in residence at the ABC, which gives her particular authority in this interview, and reckons that after 45 years in Aboriginal politics, she has sat on every board except a skateboard. Jackie, welcome.
Oh, thanks very much, David. Good to be here.
Anne McGrath holds the Hancock Distinguished Chair of History at ANU, where she has been leading the study of deep history for the last 6 or 7 years. Anne, welcome.
Hello.
We've got to start with you, Anne, because I want a clear, rich, neat explanation of deep history.
Oh, dear. Yes, start with the hard questions. Deep history is a really important term to us because it takes us away from this idea that the colonisers had to arrive before history on the Australian continent could start. I mean, I think that it's been a problem in Australian history that even people who realised that Aboriginal people were left out of history and started to write what was called Aboriginal history always started with the texts, as you implied. But there are so many other texts. But, you know, getting back to your question of a definition, deep history opens the scope of history, of what it can be and how it can be done. And we argue that Indigenous Australians have always been making history in their own multi-temporal, amazing ways on country, and we want to bring that out.
But isn't the history of the Crusades deep history? The history of the Assyrian Empire, that's pretty deep history, isn't it?
Well, it's pretty amazing. And, you know, there is also that term ancient history, but that's always in the Northern Hemisphere, like the Crusades. And it's always stops at Egypt and the pyramids or Rome and Greece. And sorry, but that only goes back a few thousand years in calendar time. And we know that Aboriginal history goes back at least 60,000 years. And, you know, why would Aboriginal people not have had history over that time?
Jackie, it's obvious from the records of the early colonies in Australia that the Aboriginal people here were largely despised as primitive, but there were always people who were respectful and curious about their language, their words, their beliefs, and their tales of country. Isn't it too much of a generalisation to say that history was never curious about them?
Look, I think that term prehistory is a misnomer because it's really pre-European Anglo history, if we talk about that. But you're correct, yes, there were pockets of people in the minority, I would say, David.
Yes,
that really did go out on a limb, and they wrote letters to the authorities about the conditions of Aboriginal people on missions reserves and way back before about the harsh treatment. There were people, but, I think our history, as Anne says, is, kind of really predates a whole range of histories. I mean, the pyramids and the Sphinx are really 2,000 years old
The contempt in your voice as you say that, Jackie.
I love it. We just really want to point out that there is a vast history that people need to learn, to experience, and to really be educated about. Because, David, if we don't, we just keep going on in our country without having these very deep conversations that we need to have.
But however badly we're doing it now, for the last 40 or so years, historians have turned to exactly this history, have they not? Aren't we actually celebrating something at this point rather than saying, it's got to start?
Oh, yes, definitely. And our book, Deep Histories, is evidence of that. We have amazing, mostly non-Indigenous historians coming through who do exactly the right things. They consult with community, they take it back to be vetted, they talk about these very vibrant histories. And yes, it was a lot better than Anne and I, who are the same age, by the way, and studied at the University of Queensland together 40 years ago, was it, Anne, or 50?
Yeah. Under the Bjelke-Joe regime, I might add.
But you had some pretty good historians there when you were there.
Oh, we sure did. We had what you would perceive now, but even back then, the radical historians like Ray Evans and Kay Saunders. And for me, as a young Aboriginal woman in her 20s who went back to study, David, it's the first time I ever learned that our people actually resisted, that we had an open warfare, and we wanted to protect our land and our family communities. I didn't know that before.
Hadn't been told that by family?
No, I hadn't been told that by family.
Until a white historian at Queensland University told you.
Yes, and opened my eyes, and I thought there was something not sitting right with me all these years, and I finally found out, and that was my passion for doing and uncovering more histories, and that's why I studied history.
Now, Anne, let's get down to some technicalities here. How can you write history? You can write lots of other things, but how can you write history without time?
Well, I must admit, for the general academic historian, being asked to use your historical imagination to write something that happened 65,000 years ago, most people would just say it's absolutely impossible. Speak to Indigenous custodians of country on country, and they don't actually see a gap. I mean, they may not be counting things in calendar dates, but they see history as ongoing, this amazing multi-temporal thing that happens, and, that everything on country is part of history. And as they walk on country, they see the marks of their own ancestors, and there's that sense of revelations from ancestors via country, like dear Uncle Fred, Jackie's elder And he took us to Carnarvon Gorge. And it was such a privilege because all he wanted to do was teach us about how to read the history on country, as some of the other authors do. And it's incredibly inspiring. But, you know, I'd like to sort of go back to that earlier question. You said, yes, there were non-Indigenous people who were really interested in Aboriginal culture. And hence, I think the Australian populace has understood more about Aboriginal culture through anthropology and also the dates of Aboriginal occupation through archaeology. So Aboriginal people have a timeline, perhaps in science, and they have a culture. But why shouldn't they have a history? Like, I think that the idea that Europeans had to arrive before history started is a somewhat arrogant approach. And so I think that we as historians and non-Indigenous historians and Indigenous historians alike are willing now to think about different ways that history was done and experienced both in the past and the present. And, you know, you've just got to look at rock art or the rich tradition of stories, which do compare with ancient Greece, I'd have to add. And there's just so much we can learn.
I was going to make that comparison myself, because I'm not in any way belittling this. I'm just very interested in the definitions of what we call history, because the Greeks don't call the stories of the gods history. They call it something else. And, I mean, in the Jewish tradition, there's the Bible. Now, some of it pretends to be history, but it's really not. It's story. It's powerful, important cultural story. Isn't that what we're talking about here in the main?
Well, story, when Aboriginal people talk about it, often has a capital S, you know, because it's considered really important. There are epic stories. Every inch of the landscape seems to have a story, as Jackie could share with us too.
Look, Jackie, yes, do, yes. But I'm not going to let you escape, Anne. Yes, Jackie.
Yes, you know.
I'm just talking about the naming of what's been done here.
Yes, and certainly stories is the word, of course, I guess our people would prefer to use.
And story unites all of these categories. Mm-hmm. But what is history and what is story?
Well, history, I believe, is from the non-Aboriginal version of history is the documents, the texts that were written by non-Aboriginal people, the anthropologists, the archaeologists and other social scientists about us. And, you know, it's a very formalised kind of academic interpretation of history, whereas with ours are the stories that add to those histories. So, thanks for pointing that out, David. I'd never really thought about those two versions of it before, but it is true. But the stories add to the very rich history of what I think we are all trying to do, both as Indigenous and non-Indigenous historians who write this stuff. And there has been a change, a great change, and I really do enjoy reading those texts now, including yours, David.
Oh, thank you. Now, Anne, I've given you a breather. I'm coming back to you.
Okay. No, I like the question. It's a difficult one. I think that, like, some Indigenous people talk about the history police, because it's like white people come in and they say, oh, we can tell you your history story. Hello, you know, we've found out your history.
Yes.
And it's so difficult to overcome that idea that the white people have the expertise or the Western Academy have the expertise. And it's also easy to rely on the fact that, wow, we know what evidence is. We're so good at cross-checking facts and going into the archives. Of course, it is an archives of empire that colonisers actually created, so there's obviously bias there. But I'd have to say, look at our school textbook. They were supposed to be facts. They were supposed to be based on evidence. But they were really just inscribing and asserting colonising sovereignty, that the British arrived, planted their flags, toasted the king, and therefore it became crown land. So this is a use of history that we need to unravel and deconstruct in our schools, because history, in fact, was asserting British sovereignty, and that's what it's done for our nation. And so I think that thinking about the way Indigenous people created stories, explained their universe, their world, their nation, according to their own modes of historical practice, is something we as Australians should learn. And Aboriginal people are so inclusive. So often elders will say, oh, I can teach you, I'll explain what this rock art means. And it's not like we're being left out. It's just we've got to learn different ways of appreciating the long, deep time past.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Jackie Huggins and Anne McGrath, historians, about the collection they have just edited about deep history. Now, Jackie, here am I, an elderly man, and trying to deal with new concepts, and I want you to be a little bit forgiving. But I just see the use of the word sovereignty in your book, and I just don't get it. Mm-hmm. Sovereignty for me is King Charles. It's the sovereignty of the state. It is a word that describes ultimate power. But that's not how you use it. What is the meaning of sovereignty in your book?
Well, sovereignty to me personally, and there are a range of definitions and interpretations and ideas, is that sovereignty for me is my connection to my land and the ancestors for, it's an inherent right that I have for my country and my existence, the way I live it. I see sovereignty, of course, in a very different way. It is about country, land, family, community, and being able to really address those issues. And we all say that, sovereignty can never be taken away from us because this is our country, you know. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. So we sit with that and, that certainly will never go away. But the word sovereignty, you're right, David, in terms of people getting their head around it, their ideas, is quite a complex term, idea, but it does mean different things, obviously, to Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples.
Yes, because it seems to me as a whitey that you're talking about your inalienable right of connection to land and to culture, but then you give it this name, sovereignty, which deeply, deeply implies a sort of state connection, but that's not what you're talking about.
No, personally I'm not. Other people might, and maybe historians will do that. But for me it is that, the premises that, 65,000 years here in this country states our sovereignty to ownership. David, I've heard people say you're the prior owners of this land. Well, please show me the bill of sale. Where is that?
oddly enough, there was no documentation of the taking, Jackie. Isn't that the most the strangest thing for orderly colonialists? But Anne, how do you, as a white historian, view this, what seems to be new meaning of sovereignty? And does it help? Does it help in public explanation to have the word given this meaning?
Well, I think that if you look at the traditions of early international law, say, in the 18th century, 19th century, sovereignty did not have to be just written on a piece of paper. Sovereignty was something that had to be performed. Hence we see the flags going up. Hence we see the toast to the king. Hence we see colonisation, people invading and being called settlers. I think that Aboriginal people have always performed their sovereignty through their relationship with country, kin, language, being there. Today, Aboriginal people love being on country or visiting country because that is associated with their authority over the place. But it's not authority like a king bossing everybody around. It's just such a beautiful relationship. And you know, that's why I want to get this point across, that history as sovereignty, because I think that Indigenous people around Australia have been creating history stories for a very, very long time, well before the history school textbooks were written that asserted that British had taken over. But yeah, I go back to that point of sovereignty has to be performed, and history and that relationship of this long, deep association with country is something that needs to be reckoned with as part of being Australian.
But don't we also have to reckon with colonial history? And I wonder about the ambition to decolonise the history of a colony. Jackie, can we decolonise a colony? Is it a useful ambition?
No, it's a useful ambition, but I don't believe we can. It's a bit like getting rid of racism. That's never going to happen. That will always stay with us. Unfortunately, we just need to learn both ways, as people, as humanity, to tackle it and how to survive it, you know. I know that probably in some ways, you know, there's been a real surgence of Indigenous knowledges in the academic circles, and that's been done certainly by our scholars, which try to put a different slant on every interpretation of history, but of colonisation, of, you know, cultural heritage, of a whole range of things. And, you know, I actually love going onto my country. It decolonises myself.
Right.
Every September when I go out to Carnarvon Gorge and I sit on the ground and I just feel that earth and that whole electricity just pulsating throughout my body. And I'm looking forward to doing that in a couple of months.
Jackie, I'm interested in the sort of hostility that I find in the book towards state archives.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we be hostile to them? Or surely we just need to interrogate very carefully the documents that we find there?
Yes, well, you know, state archives have been the gatekeepers of many of our records across Australia. You know, we know that. Sometimes they've been very open to our people accessing that, certainly have been open to non-Indigenous researchers accessing them far more than us, which is another thing. But you know, the records there, of course, I think they should be read in the time that they were written and what they were meant to be saying. But a lot of that is very primitive in their sense of not being able to, you know, get past the noble savagery that that defined us.
Although you were lucky to be defined as noble.
Well, yes, that's right.
Anne, how should we deal with archives? How should we deal with these colonial records?
Yes, well, a lot of Aboriginal people are super interested in reclaiming their family histories, especially Stolen Gen. As Jackie knows, she was part of some family history workshops that we ran for Indigenous women all around Australia. And, of course, they got a lot out of the archives because they sometimes found
yes.
their story. They found their story in the archives. But at the same time, it was so hurtful to see what the things that had been said about them and the terrible bias in them. So when you say hostility to the archives, perhaps some of it's coming from that. There are other ways of accessing Indigenous history, but I think they're complementary. And I think that it's interesting this term truth-telling really has got so much cachet these days.
Well, we were talking about Yuruk on the show earlier in the week.
There's a huge call for truth-telling, and it's because the colonial history, including what Jackie talked about before, that history of resistance, just wasn't told, it wasn't researched until the last couple of few decades. But I would say that a full truth-telling can't start with Captain Cook or Governor Phillip. So that's the sort of ambition we had. And of course, Jackie was our key advisor, very much part of our deep history program. You know, we're wanting to do both because obviously there's been terrible pain and hurt that is documented in those archives. But there's also other kinds of archives like the Rock Art Archive, the On Country Archive.
And Jackie, in the minute we've got left, pretty much, it's all very well for us to talk about the big issues behind deep history, but where can listeners read deep history? Where can we all go now to read this new deep history?
Yes, well, certainly our book, I think, is one of the first that will be doing that investigation and that reporting on that. Obviously, you know, we invite people to our launches, of which we'll be having around the country. And of course, you know, good books. I mean, I'm going to give a plug for Avid Reader in Brisbane, my favourite bookshop.
It's a wonderful bookshop.
Always has it. Yes, yes. And they do all the lovely launches there. And we're having our launch there in August. So, and you know, we invite everybody to come along and share in it because it's really important that we keep educating the wider public so we can get this understanding.
So, Anne, is it a matter really of saying, watch this space, the books are coming that will tell this?
Well, look, I have to also give a plug because on the 22nd of July at the Pride Centre in Melbourne, we're having our very first launch. And look, there's a lot of amazing scholars out there who are going to be doing terrific work. And, you know, I'm absolutely thrilled to see what they're doing, including some terrific new work that's going to be happening at Carnarvon Gorge too. And let me say, it's such a privilege to work with Jackie and also especially on her country.
And thank you. And thank you both for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been talking to Jackie Huggins and Anne McGrath, who are the co-editors of Deep History, Country and Sovereignty, published by University of New South Wales Press. Thanks for joining us on the show, you two.
Thank you, David.
Coming up, Making Shade Cool Again. When we were kids, our parents shouted, "Get out of the sun!" And we obeyed. Finding shade is an Australian instinct. Our shops have awnings and our houses have verandas, or used to. We have folk songs celebrating the patchy shade of coolabah trees. We take umbrellas to the beach. But even so, here and around the world, shade is becoming a mark of privilege as town planners and developers turn against shadows, even as heat waves become the planet's deadliest natural disasters. In the face of all this, the environmental journalist Sam Block has written Shade, the Promise of a Forgotten Natural Resource. Sam joins me now from New York. Sam, welcome to Late Night Live.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sam, this story starts for you at a bus stop in Los Angeles.
That's right. I live in New York now, but I used to live in Los Angeles, and I think the first time I saw shade for what it really was at a bus stop. Now, I was one of the many millions of Angelenos who was able to afford to drive to work, and as I bumbled down from my hillside neighborhood and scooted through groves of eucalyptus and oak and walnut trees that had been planted 100 years earlier, my journey took me down a barren, tree-bereft street that culminated, let's say, at a traffic light in front of a bus stop where I noticed passengers queuing up and waiting for their ride, just standing behind telephone poles and behind stop signs, trying to contrive whatever meager shelter they could from the sun in a city that evidently hadn't made any such affordances for the as I later discovered, 700,000 or so people who get on a bus every day in Los Angeles. And that didn't seem right to me, and it didn't seem fair because Los Angeles is a warming city. It's a city where the people who ride the bus tend to be the poorest and most vulnerable to the effects of heat. And I just didn't understand why it was so difficult just to put a roof over the heads of these people who so badly needed some shade.
You now live in New York City. Tell us about the modern politics of shade as it's playing out there.
Yeah, New York and Los Angeles are two very different cities, right? And New York is important in the story of shade because this is where zoning was created. Zoning is a legal tool that urban planners use to control the form of their commercial and their residential and even their industrial districts. And when zoning was invented and then codified in the early 20th century, this was a time when it was believed that daytime darkness and shadows were actually bad for public health. It was believed that tuberculosis thrived in daytime darkness and in shadows. It was believed that dark, airless, stuffy tenement districts, which were packed with immigrants, these were breeding grounds for not just, you know, physical diseases, but also moral diseases and abjection, like crime and depression. And urban planners worked very hard in New York to institute new rules to control the form of buildings, principally to admit more sunlight. You know, New York is famous for these Art Deco era buildings that are sort of tiered and stepped back like wedding cakes. And that's all designed to let more sun strike the lower floors of the buildings across the street. New York is also where height limits were sort of codified on buildings, right? You could only make them so tall based on the width of the street, and that was, again, to minimize the size of the shadow. And these rules, these height limits, these setbacks, these stepbacks, these all became foundational for rules that were adopted all over America and have basically been untouched since then. So, you know, today, shadow avoidance is pretty much just a basic tenet of American urban design. But some cities, New York included, have even gone farther beyond just the sort of baked-in shadow avoidance. There are all sorts of crazy political and social stigma and rules associated with shadow creation. People believe, again, that it's bad for their health. They believe that it creates crime. But what I write about in my book is that it's also an index of inequality, that if you look at a typical American city, the places that have the most leafy trees and luscious greenery tend to be the richer ones, and they tend to be the white Caucasian neighborhoods. So, you know, this may seem trivial, but as temperatures continue to rise and as heat waves become more extreme, having access to shade and having access to tree cover is going to be very important and even determinative in I would say, surviving on a warmer planet.
But Sam, isn't the question here really that you need shade when you need shade? But in winter, for instance, particularly I would have thought in New York, but it's the same is true in Melbourne or Sydney, in winter you want to get some sun into your house.
Yeah, fair enough. But I also think that culturally Americans, for the most part, now I'm sort of generalizing here, but let's just stick to New York for a second, are sort of, you know, conditioned to really think of the winter as being the big threat to their health. It's seldom appreciated that heat is already America's number one weather-related killer. More people die from high temperatures in America than they die from hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, and wildfires. You know, the cold, I think, is something that we all sort of feel innately, but heat, it doesn't strike us the same way, right? Nothing is freezing over or maybe literally catching on fire on a hot day. So we don't think of it as this danger. Yes, of course, in the middle of winter, the idea that we should be erecting huge skyscrapers to steal our sunlight is probably laughable and anathema to a lot of people. But there are so many other solutions I talk about in my book. I mean, trees are just one of them. There are awnings, there are canopies. You mentioned verandas, which I think are a beautiful tradition in Australia. There's so many other ways to make shade. We just have to loosen our regulations and to sort of and decide that it's something important for everyone.
You realize how brave you're being here, don't you? Because you're challenging one of the oldest maxims that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Sam Block is saying, no, we need shadow.
Well, what's the expression, right? Only mad dogs and Englishmen are no to go out in the midday sun or something like that?
We can have a war of cliches here. Yes, you're right. You look at ancient cities and you look at the way they absolutely valued shade. Now, they were cities built in the hottest places on Earth, weren't they? The formative cities of our civilization.
Yeah. One city that I talk about in my book, and I love this example, is the Mesopotamian city of Ur, located in the Fertile Crescent in modern-day Iraq. This is one of the cradles of human civilization. And according to an archaeologist who I spoke to, thousands of years ago, this city and many others like it were very likely designed specifically to minimize exposure to the sun. You know, the houses back then were only about 10 feet tall, but they were packed really close together. So you would traverse this network of really narrow canyon-like alleys that were pretty much plunged in the shade of other buildings. And between the narrowness of the streets, the diagonal orientation of the grid, and even other protrusions like vertical rooftop parapets and horizontal eaves, it's very likely that these ancient Mesopotamian cities offered this shadow network that was so much more comfortable than this brutal blazing plain beyond the city walls. I mean, it was explained to me that according to Sumerian mythology, one of the reasons that gods even commanded humans to build cities at all, the whole reason this sort of settlement form exists, is to create shade for the gods to refresh themselves in. I mean, this was such a different time. You know, shade was pretty much the only way to stay cool. And, you know, in this blazing hot summer that could probably reach like 50 degrees Celsius, having shade wasn't just physically important. It took on this larger-than-life quality. It became supernatural or cultic. I mean, I mentioned this Sumerian myth about creating shade, but there are all these superstitions about shady houses and cool houses being luckier than sunnier ones.
And then later on, the Greeks built cities that had shade. The Romans built cities that shade was a kind of an imperial gift to the cities.
Yeah, that's right. So the Greeks valued shade for a different reason. I mean, the Mediterranean is a hot place, but it couldn't be quite as brutal as the Middle East. You know, this was the ancient Greeks wanted to conduct their affairs not behind closed doors, but in public and in full view of one another. So they would meet in stoas, which were these monumental stone colonnades that surrounded the agora or the town square. And in these covered open halls, this is where you had the convening of the popular assembly, the hearings of the magistrates, the displays of laws and arts, social gatherings, popular education. I mean, the philosophers that we know today, like Socrates and Zeno, they would stroll in the shade of the stoa, and that's where they would lecture for public audiences. And in fact, Aristotle, when he started his philosophical school of the Peripatetics, that was actually taken from the Greek word peripatoi, meaning shady walks. So this Greek culture and this way of life, this sort of aspiration of democracy and of public representation, this was all found in the shade of the stoa.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Sam Block about shade. Sam, those ancient cities didn't seem to provide shade by planting trees. That seems to have been something that cities just didn't do. Yes, arcades. Yes, great buildings where people could shelter, but not planting trees. Why not?
Well, let's think about all the problems that trees might cause in cities, right? You plant a big one in the road and these roots can tear, you know, in today's world into plumbing or buckle, wrap around a sewer line. But, you know, hundreds of years ago, these roots would probably lift the pavement and sort of get in the way of things. You know, it was believed that tree branches caused fires and were fueling these conflagrations. Trees were this icon of rurality. Trees were an icon of the forest, which a lot of Europeans were very afraid of. I mean, the word savage comes from the Latin word silva for tree. This whole idea that the forest was a place where you had Robin Hood-like robbers, where you had dangerous things happening, those were all things that belonged outside the city walls, belonged in nature. you know, the city was stone and civilization. So this idea that trees would come into play and create the necessary shade that people needed for cooling didn't really take effect until, you know, at least in America, the 17th and 18th century, and really the 19th century, after things like fire insurance came along, after sort of modern progress, basically, shorn trees of their stigma, let's say.
And after the miasma theory. Tell us about the miasma theory.
Right. So in the 18th century, American cities were contending with disaster in the form of yellow fever, this really intense disease that was decimating American cities. I think a really bad yellow fever attack, let's say, I think killed 10% of people who lived in Philadelphia, which at the time was America's capital. And there was this anxiety and worry about, you know, what is going to happen if we have all these people dying from yellow fever in the summer, and you have leading minds and physicians starting to think, well, you know, part of the reason why we have this disease is because of miasmas, which are basically bad airs or vapors. And their belief was that these bad airs were being released from the ground when it was being heated and exposed to sun. So in my book, I talk about different theories about different ways to shade city streets to make sure that they wouldn't get struck with sun and release these bad airs. You know, Noah Webster, who Americans know as the guy in the dictionary, he thought that Middle Eastern design of making narrow roads might actually make a lot of sense in that way. Another physician thought that maybe it was best to build like the Spaniards did with a minimum of windows. Again, the sort of idea of a shady and a cool house. But they all decided that wasn't really right for America, and they didn't want to act like these other, you know, foreign cultures, and that trees, nature's coolers, would be the ones that could help them shade city streets. So in addition to cooling the surfaces and preventing them from getting heated by the sun, they also believed that trees had this other power, that their foliage could absorb the noxious gases and kind of clean and purify the air and get rid of whatever was causing yellow fever. Now, we know that's not true. We know now that yellow fever is spread by mosquitoes, but they were onto something. Trees do purify the air and they do absorb gases, just not the ones they were thinking of.
And that's kind of modern thinking today, isn't it, about the role of trees in cities? But before we go there, let's go back right to the beginning, because you also argue that shade is an essential quality of really the evolution of life.
So I was surprised to learn when I was researching this book that 99% of animal species of life on planet Earth can be classified as ectothermic, meaning animals that don't really have metabolisms. They can't really control the way that they create heat or dispel heat, that their bodies are very closely tied to the environments that they're in. And so I talk about Chinook salmon in the Pacific Northwest, for example. These are animals that like their water really cold. And when it comes time for them to spawn in the summer and in the fall, after they make their way upstream and they look for a place to, you know, lay their eggs and create more life, they have to do it somewhere cool. So, you know, their bodies would overheat really quickly if they were in the sun. So they're just naturally drawn to the shade as a place to do that. There are lots of animal species that need shade for this sort of thermoregulation is what scientists call it, right? The controlling of body temperature. You know, humans, we are blessed with this amazing ability to sweat. That's mostly how we control heat in our bodies. But some scientists that I talk to think that just on the largest, longest scale of organic animal evolution, let's say, that the idea to sweat and the other forms of sort of internal body thermoregulation really only appeared very recently, that for most of animal life on planet Earth, it has really been about finding shade. And these newer things, these things that we think make us human, are really very new. So, you know, when we sweat, that makes us human. But when we run into the shade to cool down, that's what makes us just another animal.
So we should think of ourselves not as products of the grasslands, but of the forest.
Well, we'll never really know. The savanna hypothesis, this idea that we became humans out under the sun, out on the African plain, That's where we became bipedal. That's where we sort of learned to stand upright. You know, in the past 20 or 30 years or so, archaeologists and anthropologists have uncovered some evidence that might suggest that humans actually learned to walk when they were in the forest, that in the trees is actually where we discovered our humanity.
Let's roll forward a few billion years to the discovery in the early 1900s by a man called Carrier of a way of cooling air and how that has transformed our relationship to shade.
Right. Let's go to the one of the first years of the 20th century in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. There's a magazine printing plant that is trying to issue like the new issue of this humor magazine, but it's a really sticky, humid New York summer, and all the pages are getting stuck together and the registrations are getting destroyed. And someone from the heating company comes in, this guy Willis Carrier, who's trying to figure out a way to remove the humidity from the printing plant and to dry the air. And he has this idea of basically piping in chilled, cool air inside the factory floor, and in the process, removing the hot air and expelling it back outside. Again, this is all just to control the humidity, but the byproduct becomes the cooling. And that really becomes the thing that makes air conditioning this magnificent invention that spreads not just from the floors of this printing plant, but then to textile mills. It spreads to other factories. It spreads to banks. It spreads to offices. It spreads to the halls of government where people can start working on and legislating all year round. It spreads to movie theaters. You know, Americans start sitting through this summer dreck just to stay cool.
Yes.
And then eventually air conditioning comes home. And, you know, in my book, I talk about how when air conditioning comes home, this is really the beginning of the end for a lot of the sort of historical shade strategies and sort of shady architecture that Americans and people all around the world used to rely on to stay cool. Because once you have this machine that you can kind of just pop into like a port in your home, you know, as a developer and as a builder, you're passing on the cost of cooling to the occupant. And to be clear, air conditioning is so much more powerful than shade. I mean, shade helps you tolerate your environment. Shade helps you stay cool. Air conditioning obliterates heat. It completely smashes it. So it's understandable that most people would want this machine that works so much better than an awning or a sleeping porch or an overhanging eave. But at the same time, I don't think people understood back then the amount of energy that it would cost or the amount of energy that would be consumed to cool so many homes, the way it would transform architecture, the way it would transform our cities. And as I argue, the way it would transform the planet with the huge amount of greenhouse gases associated with the machine itself, and then the energy that's consumed to power these cooling machines, are a significant contributor to global warming. And today, we're sort of stuck in this trap where we have to stay cool inside at the expense of ever more hellish conditions outside.
You've got an amazing statistic in the book that 88% of households in the United States have air conditioning. That's just a staggering number. Nearly everyone.
Yeah, and I do want to defend, let's say, the widespread adoption of air conditioning in the United States just for a bit, because, you know, the United States has different climates. Where I live in New York, I don't really use air conditioning for most of the year. But, you know, people who live in the Southeast United States, where it's very hot and humid throughout the year, people who live in the very dry, arid Southwest, you know, you have high temperatures pretty much all year. And before air conditioning, these were much sleepier, more desolate areas where you didn't have a lot of people living because it was just a lot harder to make it. Air conditioning is really what enables the way of life in a lot of these southern cities. So that high uptake, that high rate of air conditioning in the United States is basically the sign of us conquering innate climate through machine technology.
Yes, it's not in Australia, the uptake is not nearly as big. Oh, look, before I talk about Australia, Sam, tell us how wonderful we are.
Well, Australians, my understanding is that you have had it drummed into your head for decades now that sun avoidance is an important cultural practice. In fact, Australians have a jingle and a catchy mnemonic, slip, slop, slap, that is foreign to Americans, but which I understand every Australian of a certain age can sing easily. You know, in America, our most popular mnemonic is about escaping homes during fires, which is a very rare event for most people. We don't have this sort of daily awareness of having to get out of the sun the way that Australians do.
And you know, slip, slop, slap. The stuff we're slip, slop, slapping on us is a kind of shade that you get out of a tube.
Well, I quibble with this a little bit because the shade in a tube that you get from sunscreen, that protects your skin from UV radiation. And UV radiation is dangerous and it causes skin cancer, but it doesn't protect your skin from the infrared rays in the sun, which is where most of the heat is. So when you put on, when you slather sunscreen on your skin, the only heat protection that it really offers you is in the white coloring, because that is sort of solar reflective. It's a kind of shade, but it doesn't protect you from heat the same way a proper awning or a canopy does.
But it has to be remembered that my predecessor in this job, Philip Adams, was the guy who in his advertising days, invented that jingle. Pretty extraordinary. Now, Sam, we've only got a few moments left. What are the cities that are doing best in the world at the moment in dealing with approaching warming and the dangers of heat waves?
Well, I don't think any city is really doing a good enough job because we know pretty much it's pretty much settled scientifically that if cities decided to fill the streets and roads and parks and cram trees into every nook and cranny of public space, it is possible to lower the air temperature of cities, and that's just not happening. So it's within reach to basically shade out a lot of the effects of climate change. Now, that said, there are cities that are doing things that are replicable and scalable. In the book, I went to Western Europe and I went to Barcelona in Spain, and what they've been doing there is reclaiming space from cars and giving it back to pedestrians and to bikers and to trees. So they're closing streets and they're depaving asphalt and they're putting in tree pits and tree wells where there used to be cars stored, let's say. And that's super important because the more asphalt that you remove from a city and the more vegetation and shading that you put in, that lowers the temperature, so that mitigates climate change. And then by doing that, you're also adapting to climate change. So it's both, you know, addressing the cause of the warming and also doing something about living with it. So that's a really good approach. And that's being emulated now in cities in the United States as well.
And it looks beautiful.
Who wouldn't love to walk down a tree under kissing canopies of arching London planes and jacarandas? It's gorgeous.
Sam, thank you. Sam Block has written this splendid book, Shade, The Promise of a Forgotten Natural Resource. And Sam, one of the pleasures of your book are the photographs of people instinctively gathering in shade. They're hilarious as well as heartwarming. Is that why you chose them?
Well, I chose those photos because I think shade gets a bad rap. I mean, we talked about this at the beginning. You asserted that everyone wants sun, and I'm this lone shade maniac, Don Quixote, trying to say that that shadows are the important thing. But these photographs I included in the book of people sort of unconsciously being drawn to shadows just demonstrates the innate need and the innate magnetism of shade. It's something that we all crave, even if we don't know that we're craving it. It's been forgotten, but I think our body sort of knows it.
Look for the cover, ladies and gentlemen, where you'll see a little knot of people sitting on a grassy bank in the shade that is cast by a palm tree. Sam, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And that's the show and the week. We'll be back next week with more of the stories we know you loved in 2025. Rivers as Living Beings with Robert McFarlane, The Trial of Augusto Pinochet with Philippe Sands, and a wildly funny conversation with Hannah Rosen of Atlantic Magazine and her partner Lauren Ober on finding themselves living next door in Washington to a MAGA martyr. Thanks to the team that puts this show together, led by Jack Schmidt, that's S-C-H-M-I-D-T, and the fabulous Elena Katz-Chernin, who gave us this theme, the Chatterbox Rag.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.